This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The top college food trends. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up during this program.
As students move back into their dorms and off-campus apartments, Grubhub has put together a list of things they're most likely to order as takeout food.
More people are celebrating the age of 60 rather than bemoaning it. Find out how they're marking the occasion.
Ahead of this big bout this weekend, a look at the man behind the expensive wardrobe of mixed martial arts fighter Conor McGregor.
And investors aren't happy with the drop in the number of us going to theaters this summer. But they are optimistic about the fall.
We've got a new Justice League movie from DC Comics. And then, of course, in late December, the next installment of Star Wars comes out. And the CEO of AMC called that movie a gift from heaven, because you always know the Star Wars movies are going to make a lot of money.
Wall Street Journal reporter Eric Schwartzel on anxious theaters in the face of expected upheaval in the industry. He's here later in the hour. Although a few communities are removing a few statues, the nation's Confederate memorial infrastructure, estates, plantations, battlefields, graveyards, birthplaces, shrines, and the like, is too vast and diverse to be moved, hidden, or even destroyed. USA Today national correspondent Rick Hampson has been looking into it. Rick, what have you found?
Gordon, as you know, the debate has been recently over what to do with these Confederate memorials around the country, statues, all sorts of various things. But there's another issue, which is whether they can be moved or removed or destroyed or put into storage. Some things aren't statues that you can easily move into a museum. There's things such as these giant stone carvings on the side of Stone Mountain in Georgia. There's whole boulevards that are dedicated to this Confederate heritage. Even in Arlington National Cemetery, Robert E. Lee's former homestead is the official national memorial to Robert E. Lee. Nobody seems to be proposing getting rid of that. So there's this stuff all over the country, and even if one decided it was time to stamp out the Confederate heritage, it would be a big job to do it.
Yeah. Boy, so going forward, I guess it's a difficult road to see ahead, and that question sort of looms, and many have asked it, right? What happens next, or where do you draw the line? What have you found in your research here?
Well, Lee's a great example. Of course, there's a lot of pressure to take Lee's, to remove Lee's statue from that park in Charlottesville, Virginia, and his statue has already been removed from New Orleans and several other places around the country, because, of course, Lee was basically the top general in the Confederate Army, which was both a treasonous revolt against the United States and a fight to preserve slavery. The problem with Lee, however, is that if you want to be consistent, you have things such as this Lee Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery, and you have Lee's likeness carved into the side of Stone Mountain, Georgia. So you have to decide if Lee is such a bad guy, if he was such a bad guy, why would you leave him in some places and get rid of him in others?
Right.
And then you would move to other figures from the Confederacy, such as Stonewall Jackson, Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy. It's just kind of a conundrum as to who to move against first and whether or not you're erasing history by doing so.
Right. We're speaking with Rick Hampson, national correspondent at USA Today. His piece is called America's Confederate Infrastructure, Too Big to Hide, Move, or Raise. What are some of the more, I don't know, reasonable voices proposing here, if that's such a thing?
Well, I think a good example is Richmond, Virginia, capital of the state, where you have this boulevard called Monument Avenue. It's developed around the 1890s, and it's distinguished by a series of statues down this grassy median that stretches the length of the boulevard of people like Lee and Stonewall Jackson, Jeb Stuart, and Jefferson Davis. And this was thought to be part of the Southern heritage. In 2008, the American Planning Association called it one of the 10 best avenues in the country. It has this very stately, processional feel to it. It's lined on either side with very gracious, beautiful homes and buildings. Now, if you're an African-American, a statue of people like that means something else other than the genteel life of the Old South.
Right.
So they formed a commission. The mayor of Richmond has formed a commission to study this, and it includes a lot of distinguished academics, community leaders, and they're going to be thrashing this out. But their first meeting a couple of weeks ago was kind of a Donnybrook. People felt very strongly pro and con. And this commission is supposed to figure out some way to contextualize these statues, to tell the full story, and not just glorify the Confederacy.
So is it coming down to community leaders basically making these decisions, or in some cases is it, state lawmakers?
Well, state lawmakers have been much more averse to changing this, especially in the South and the Mid-South. Tennessee and North Carolina, state legislatures have expressly passed laws saying you can't touch these kinds of things. Some communities, like Charlottesville, which are more liberal, or Richmond, which is more liberal, are looking at these things and want to do something. I think in the case of Richmond, the mayor does have the power to remove those statues because Virginia doesn't have any state law. But if you want to do that in Tennessee or North Carolina as a locality, you run up against state law. So it's yet another sort of avenue for fighting over this between the different jurisdictions, different parties. In Virginia, for instance, the Democratic nominee for governor has said that Richmond statues should come down. The Republican nominee seems to want to leave them the way they are.
There you go. Thanks, Rick. USA Today national correspondent Rick Hampson. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Omaha Steaks offers a huge variety from premium steaks to skillet meals. This summer, I've enjoyed grilling them at barbecues. They also make the perfect business gift. Their gifts offer unique home cooking experiences from a trusted brand known for quality. Right now, you can experience for yourself what makes these business gifts so unique with an exclusive offer. Order the perfect business gift to try the Omaha Steaks gift experience for yourself or send it as a gift. The perfect business gift includes 4 bacon-wrapped tri-tip steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 gourmet franks, 2 boneless pork chops, 4 kielbasa sausages, plus free shipping and 4 caramel apple tartlets. This exclusive package is only $59.99. Go to omahasteaks.com, type deal in the search bar, and choose the perfect business gift. Again, omahasteaks.com. Enter the code DEAL in the search bar to send or experience this exclusive gift package for only $59.99. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Baby boomers are turning 60 this year at a record high rate. But how they choose to celebrate or avoid the number varies greatly. Here's Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry. Claire, what's going on?
Not only is it okay to party when you turn 60, but you have a lot of company this year. The peak of the baby boom was in 1957, so with 4.3 million babies being born that year. So this year, baby boomers are turning 60 at a rate of about 491 an hour. And, you know, they're different than their parents' generations in better health, more sophisticated about health care, exercise, nutrition. So they're feeling pretty good about their future. You know, some of them, especially men it seems, look at 60 and they worry about retirement and their identity wrapped up with their career. And so it seems from a lot of people that it's harder for men, and that women, you know, who are more concerned about appearances or things like that, they've adjusted earlier. And they're also taking things in stride, having, you know, the kids out of the house and looking at it as this is their time.
Yeah. Tell me about this couple you spoke to, this Mike and Robin Hamlin. They did the 120 party that they did.
Right. Each turned 60 this year, and Mike's birthday was in March, Robin's was in May. You know, they celebrated it quietly with Mike's birthday, a birthday party or dinner out with their daughter. But then when they were, they had been doing a lot of traveling to take care of Robin's parents in Florida, and it had been stressful. And Mike just said, you know what, we can't let these, we need a big bash, and we can't let the next 10 years slip away from us. And he lost his business partner, who died suddenly of a heart attack at the age of 60, and his own dad died at the age of 70. So, you know, that was all weighing on him and in the back of his mind, too, about how life is short. So instead of looking at 60 with dread and doom and gloom, you know, let's celebrate. You know, these could be the best 10 years of our lives. You know, they're financially secure, so they don't have those worries. And he figures, you know, this is the time we're in good health. You know, we're secure financially. We've got kids. We've got grandkids. Let's just enjoy it. So they invited about 100 close friends and family members, had a live band, danced all night, and had a great time.
Well, we're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry. Her piece is called It's Okay to Party When You Turn 60. So you point out that people in the U.S. prefer to tiptoe past their 60th birthday party. And part of that is what young people think that you're old if you're 60. Is that what we're trying to get past?
Yes. There was a survey that Pew did, and it said that 18 to 29-year-olds, they really think that old age starts at 60.
Wow.
So, you know, and one guy I talked to said he was really insulted when, you know, a clerk at McDonald's asked him if he wanted a discount, and he was 62, and he said no, he didn't want it. But he really thought, wow, I've crossed the divide. And he said the other thing, too, was he really thought he looked younger than he did. So when somebody younger looks at him and says, oh, my gosh, you are old and you deserve a discount, it really just kind of hit him in the face. You know, and people, that same study said that, you know, middle-aged respondents put the beginning of old age, or that the average person becomes old, closer to 70. And not surprisingly, as people get older, they think old age is down the line. Some people 65 and over say that the average person doesn't become old until 74. So
what's this, explain this kind of the new nickname some folks are giving to this period of transition, the gerontolescence, is how they call it.
Right. And, you know, it's like a whole new transition in life that, you know, a lot of people are starting, they're going, looking at this whole period as a time for exploration, you know, volunteering, second careers. You know, I had a lot of people respond with saying, you know, well, I started a master's class when I turned 60, and another person, you know, I went back to France and I haven't been there for 44 years. And, you know, a lot of people doing things that they have been wanting to do and just felt like, you know, this is the time to do it. You know, I heard from more than one 60-year-old who celebrated at dude ranches with their family.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I think if they're in good health, and generally 60-year-olds are, and they have the means, they're traveling, they're celebrating, they're having fun.
Thanks, Claire. Wall Street Journal columnist Claire Ansberry. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. During the back-to-school fall season, whether you're preparing a packed lunch for your kid, a weeknight dinner for the family, or even a tailgate feast, it's important to follow guidance from the USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service to prevent foodborne illness, or the food police, as we like to joke. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Whether you're preparing a packed lunch for your child or a tailgate feast for the whole crew, it's important to follow food safety rules this fall to prevent foodborne illness. Here with some tips is Marianne Gravely of the USDA. Marianne, what should we do first when packing our kids' school lunches?
Well, you always want to remember that you want to keep hot foods hot and cold foods cold. So if you're packing a hot lunch, a soup, or a stew, then use a thermos. Make sure the food is piping hot before you put it in, and preheat the thermos with hot water. If you're packing cold foods, prepare the lunch the night before and store it in the refrigerator. Even things like a piece of fruit, if you put it in the refrigerator the night before, it's going to start off cold. And then be sure to pack that lunchbox with two cold sources. Making sure that you have two cold sources will keep your child's lunch good and cold until lunchtime.
Marianne, are there foods you should just absolutely avoid when making lunch for your kids?
I wouldn't say there's anything to avoid, but I would take care in what you choose. If your child will carry a lunch and you can put those cold sources in, then most any perishable food, like even things like cheese sticks or that bologna sandwich, I used to carry one of those too, those will be safe until lunchtime. But if you are going to pack a hot food, you might want to do a little science experiment before school starts and make sure that your container will keep the food good and hot for the amount of time it takes, you know, that before your child eats lunch. Now, one thing that is kind of difficult to pack is something like pizza or chicken nuggets, because if your child isn't going to eat those cold, it's difficult to pack them and keep them hot. They just won't stay hot in the thermos, and there's not really a good container for a piece of pizza. So you just have to decide, is it going to be hot or is it going to be cold?
I was going to ask you, Marianne, about leftovers. Last night's dinner, is that something you should be particularly concerned about?
If you stored it in the refrigerator, it's perfectly safe, but if you're not going to pack it cold, then you'll want to heat it up before you package it in a thermos so that it's about, heat it to 165 and then make sure it stays above 140 in that thermos.
We're speaking with Marianne Gravely of the USDA about food safety this fall. Let's talk about cooking for a crowd, something like a tailgate where you're going to have massive amounts of food and it may be sitting out for hours on end. How do you keep things safe?
Well, you don't have to put everything out for the entire time. So just like you would if you were having a party at home, maybe bring things out in courses. Keep the foods safe in a cooler with plenty of ice, and then maybe just bring small amounts of food out. Now, some of those tailgate parties are pretty elaborate, so if you're going to have electricity and you can use a slow cooker or a warming tray to keep things hot, that's fine. But if you're only serving cold foods, you don't want them to sit out more than 2 hours, only 1 hour if it's 90 degrees or hotter. So if that's the case, just put small portions of food out and then replace them with fresh.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Marianne Gravely at the USDA. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.com. Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, the top college food and delivery trends. Also, big problem for movie theaters besides duds this summer. And the man who dresses MMA fighter Conor McGregor. That story in about 20 minutes. Time now for a travel update, and it's brought to you by Lexington Hotels. Hello Rewards is our way of saying thank you to guests at Lexington and Red Lion Hotels. Enjoy our best rates and personalized perks. Book your hotel stay today. A new study finds that noise from aircraft, traffic, and commercial development is drowning out the natural quiet of many wilderness areas and parks. It's in the journal Science. In fact, there's even an acoustic biologist employed by the National Park Service. It's a story from Wall Street Journal science writer Lee Hotz. Lee, what's this about?
Well, it's no secret that, you know, sales of earbuds and headphones and sound deafeners are going up. But what researchers at the National Park Service and Colorado State University out in Fort Collins have shared with us through new research published in Science Thursday, the first and most comprehensive assessment of just how much noise human beings make in the nation's protected parklands. I mean, we're talking the places that people go to get away from the din of daily life. And what they found while perhaps not startling, is nonetheless surprising. In more than two-thirds of the nation's parklands, and now we're talking about federal parks, we're talking about protected wilderness areas, but we're also talking about state parks and city parks and, you know, urban centers, so it's very much across the board. What they found is that in more than two-thirds of U.S. protected areas, people make so much noise that they've actually doubled the background level of sound in these places.
All right, so you mentioned things like ringing phones, the rumble of road traffic, the clatter of mining, drilling, logging. But that stuff's been around for some time. Is it newly a bad situation, or are we finally putting this out and saying, here's how problematic it's been for a long time?
Well, it's a little of both. The sources of the noise, primarily, the scientists tell me, are aircraft flying overhead. One independent study of Grand Canyon National Park a couple of years ago determined that overflights in Grand Canyon had reached 55,000 flights a day. That on the busiest days over the Grand Canyon, there were 100 helicopters in the air. And some of the spot sound checks they did there showed peak noise levels as much as 76 decibels. To answer your question, so cars, roads, which of course are in there to make the parks and places more accessible, so there's a kind of a paradox there, aircraft, and increasing commercial development, and we're talking oil, drilling, fracking, mining. But the big things are cars and aircraft, they told me, and you know, motorcycles and such. It's clearly not something they can put on a timeline yet. This is an ongoing project. They've done, I think the number is 492 protected areas so far.
Wall Street Journal science writer Lee Hotz, 22 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. As America's college kids move into their campus housing, here's a story about one of their favorite pastimes, eating. Grubhub, the online takeout marketplace, has done some research on the hottest food and delivery trends at schools around the country. Here's Caitlin Carl, trends expert at Grubhub. Caitlin, what are they ordering?
We found that some pretty stereotypical college food trends were included, such as boneless wings were the most ordered food by college students. You have cheese pizza in the second spot. And the third spot, which I thought was actually pretty unique, was the fact that taco salad was ordered 879% more by students than others. So while it's, you know, still taco is part of the name, there's a salad in there as well.
What do you think was some of the most cringeworthy data that came out of this?
Well, I think there was quite a variety in what students ordered. I mean, we saw things such as mac and cheese calzones, which I did not know existed, but we also saw food such as Cuban sandwiches as well. So really a widespread choice of college favorites here. And then you have your traditional Chinese cuisine takeout. You have oven roasted wings. Even honey butternut biscuits were one of the top ordered foods by college students. So quite the wide array, but I would say that these are very shareable, very comfort foods per se, which makes sense when students are away from home for the first time and maybe looking for a little extra comfort from their dish instead of mom and dad.
One thing that jumped out at me when I was looking at these numbers, students are 79% more likely to order late night meals than other diners. Speaks to those late hours of studying or socializing or partying, I guess.
Yes. So we did see that students are much more likely to order during the late night hours than a regular Grubhub user. And it makes sense when you think about what drives students to stay up so late, whether it's late night at the library, they got a great spot at a table and don't want to leave and just want the food brought to them, or if perhaps they were socializing late into the hours and wanted to grab a meal before they head to bed late at night. And when we looked into the schools, actually, that were ordering the most late-night meals, we found that Morgan State came in the first place, Michigan State in second, and the Berklee College of Music placed third in the schools that order the most late-night dishes.
How about this? We're speaking with Caitlin Carl, trends expert at Grubhub.com. They've put together a survey about the top college food and delivery trends just as schools getting back in session. How about the most caffeinated schools? What'd you find there?
Yes. So at the top spot, we found that University of Chicago orders the most caffeinated beverages out of any other school in the country. In the second spot, we found that MIT is ordering a lot of caffeinated beverages. And in the number three spot, we found that Babson College orders plenty of caffeinated beverages. And what we found that was so unique was that students are actually 10% more likely to order energy drinks than other diners. Mm. So this study took into account energy drinks, coffee, and tea, but it really looks like students may be turning to energy drinks as their source of caffeine.
Well, there's some concern for that as well, I guess. But how about the healthiest schools to shed some good news on this?
Absolutely. So while we do have our schools turning, you know, very unique calzones, we also see that schools are turning to healthy dishes as well. So we found that Penn ranked number one as the healthiest school in America. And in the second spot, we saw Rollins College. And in the third spot, we found Johnson and Wales University as the number three healthiest school in the U.S.
Thanks, Caitlin. Caitlin Carl, trends expert at Grubhub. 15 minutes now in front of the hour. On This Weekend.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Networks Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS. AWS to learn more.
Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. A decline in attendance at the movies this summer has put theater chains in a weak position in the eyes of investors, especially with expectations of upheaval in the industry. Wall Street Journal reporter Eric Schwartzel says blame a steady stream of lackluster major releases. Eric, set this up.
So the big three exhibitors, AMC, Regal, and Cinemark, have all had a really bruising summer on Wall Street. Their stocks have really steadily declined because you've seen a number of big titles like King Arthur and Transformers and The Mummy really miss expectations, and in some cases just outright flop. And traders have responded to that, and the stocks have fallen. But what we found was that investors also think that this drop in attendance has exposed the longer-term problem facing the theaters, which is that the studios are inevitably going to start shortening the exclusivity window the theaters have to show movies. And that means that consumers will at some point be able to watch first-run movies in the home sooner than they do now. And it's really unclear what those deals would look like, if the theaters would get a piece of it, and what that would do to attendance overall.
Wow. What are the flops that are kind of shouldering the blame?
Well, it's not necessary. There are some outright flops like King Arthur, which cost $175 million to make. And when you have a production budget that size, I would say anything, you know, less than $200 million is a disappointment. Now, it made $40 million.
It was Vortigern who murdered your father. But what you didn't account for is what you can do with this sword.
So you've got a huge flop there. But I think the other thing that's happened is a number of titles just haven't made as much as they should have. And it's not that they were total flops, but they were just general disappointments, like the R-rated Baywatch movie.
I thought we were lifeguards.
Everything that you guys are talking about sounds like a really entertaining but far-fetched TV show.
The Dark Tower, the latest Pirates of the Caribbean. No one would say these are really going to, you know, crater a studio balance sheet, but they didn't come close to what exhibitors and studio execs hoped they would when they greenlit them at the budgets they did.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Eric Schwartzel about his piece entitled Movie Theaters Have a Bigger Problem Than This Summer of Duds. So for the likes you mentioned before of AMC, Regal, Cinemark, are there strategies here? Does the fourth quarter look promising, for example?
It does. The fourth quarter is what everyone is looking toward. I think I got the sense from interviewing exhibition executives that they'd love to go hibernate until then, because the third quarter looks good, but not great. It's traditionally a pretty quiet time. You can see that at what's coming out at the box office this weekend and the next several weekends. There aren't a lot of major titles. The fourth quarter will make up some lost ground for sure. We've got a new Thor movie from Marvel. We've got a new Justice League movie from DC Comics. And then, of course, in late December, the next installment of Star Wars comes out. And the CEO of AMC called that movie a gift from heaven, because you always know the Star Wars movies are going to make a lot of money. This year, they're really going to look for it to make a lot of money, because they need to compensate for some of these lousy returns this summer.
All right, so why the decline this summer? I mean, because the economy's good, so is it just lousy creativity at the box office, or we just have different expectations or distractions?
Yeah, I'd say the economy is good and the movies are bad. Every year is a little cyclical, right? It'll go up and down a couple percentage points, and that margin of error really seems to be if the movies resonate or not.
Thanks, Eric. Wall Street Journal reporter Eric Schwartzel. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Reminder, by the way, that we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook or look us up on Twitter. We use the username at This Morning Show. If you like a little cynicism and sarcasm, you can follow me directly on Twitter with the username at Gordon Deal. Thanks for being with us. A team of designers, seamstresses, and tailors in Costa Mesa, California have been working on the secret details of the boxing robe that Conor McGregor will wear in his fight against Floyd Mayweather. USA Today says even the mixed martial arts star himself will not see it until he's in his dressing room at T-Mobile Arena Saturday night.
I'm going to outbox this man at his own game. That's how skilled and how much of a different level I am to him.
Unlikely. The man responsible for the robe, by the way, is David August Heil, who estimates that McGregor each year spends more than $1 million on clothes. A good chunk of that money ends up with Mr. Heil, who said McGregor spends up to $8,500 per suit, as much as $10,000 on a sports coat, and dress shirts that range from $600 to $900 each when he's ordering from Mr. Heil. His clients have included Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. McGregor's collection of Heil's three-piece suits, by the way, numbers in the hundreds. The prized creation is wool and pinstriped. In fact, McGregor wore it for the press stop in Los Angeles last month and proudly showed off the pinstripes, which read, F-U. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.